It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine legislation circulating in the legislature targeting how utilities are regulated and potential effects on customer rates. The Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin is an advocacy group that tracks regulatory issues, and Tom Content is its executive director. Call in with a question. You can share your comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Oh, great to be back with you, Kate.
Well, starting with this package from Republican State Senators Rob Coles of Green Bay and Dewey Strobel of Sockville proposing to make changes to how utilities are regulated by the Public Service Commission. Let's start with what is problematic with how utilities are regulated now.
We have a couple of big issues, and some of these your listeners heard about last week on your show with former Chair Vok, but it's how we're planning our system for the future, the ability of the PSC to take a more holistic view and analyze the utilities plans as a whole instead of piece by piece. That's a big problem that we're not doing that today and would be fixed by these bills. And saving money when the coal plants shut down, so that utilities aren't profiting for a decade or more after these coal plants are shut down. That's another big challenge. We think those are two big problems that would, if solved, would help make the clean energy transition much more affordable for customers.
So one of these bills, as you say, would require utilities to regularly report to the Public Service Commission on their future plans for the power grid. So we're going now more upstream for the PSC to get involved. How would a mandate like this help energy customers?
Well, right now, when the PSC reviews projects, they review them kind of piecemeal, piece by piece, project by project. And what we see in other states like Minnesota and other states is that when you review the whole plan, you can take a look at the big picture and really see what's most cost effective for customers. And one of the keys in those plans is it really empowers the regulator to really not just take a holistic view, but actually really be judicious about what makes the most sense over the long term, and what role should saving energy play in assuring reliability? Because if everybody were to save energy on the hottest day of the year, and we had more programs in place to do that, it would actually reduce the amount of overbuilding that can happen when we don't have a good planning process, which is what's been happening in Wisconsin.
How would this affect clean energy goals? The Public Service Commission being involved in a more integrated approach to long-term planning, what would that mean for clean energy?
I think clean energy would happen regardless. Clean energy is cost effective. Solar is actually more cost effective than most other forms of generation, wind and solar. They're layering on batteries and energy storage to help make the solar extend that after the sun stops shining or the wind stops blowing. So I don't think that it would be a great change. What it would do is make sure everything is more cost effective.
Tom Content is here, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin, as we talk about proposed legislation circulating that pertains to utilities and how they're regulated. You can join in questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234. Tom, one bill would allow the Public Service Commission to reopen rate cases and reduce the amount a utility can recover for investments in energy generation if the market conditions change. How often do energy investments end up costing less than anticipated?
It has happened, but unfortunately, we've seen challenges with cost overruns. We're seeing that right now with the Cardinal Hickory Creek power line that is supposed to link Wisconsin and Iowa. That project is already almost $160 million over budget, and we're not sure what the end is in sight, because it still doesn't have a permit to cross the Mississippi River from the Fish and Wildlife Service. So it's a real challenge. It's a poster child for for why cost caps and having the giving the PSC more tools, not fewer tools, having cost caps and competitive bidding on big power lines is so important.
You mentioned the word tools, and when we had Rebecca Cameron Bach on our show this month, who stepped down, as you mentioned, as chair of the Public Service Commission just recently, Bach wouldn't comment specifically on the proposed utility legislation, but did say this.
I am of the belief that the more tools the commission has in its toolbox, the better off customers and, quite frankly, utilities will be.
How could customers benefit from the Public Service Commission having more power?
I mean, I think we just need strong oversight of the utilities. The utilities make money when they build. They make more. The more they build, the more they make money. And that's why there has to be a check to make sure that we're not overbuilding and that we're building effective projects, needed projects, but not overbuilding and not overspending. And that's what's critical. And so there are tools that the Public Service Commission has, and there are tools that the Midwest Grid Operator has, such as the competitive bidding I mentioned, that would go away under another bill that's in the legislature right now.
Let's take a call now. Ken in Madison is here. Ken, hi.
Hi, good morning. I'm originally from Southwest Wisconsin, and they've taken prime agricultural land by Monfort, there's three huge solar fields.
Solar farms?
That have, mm-hmm. yes, that have taken thousands of acres of prime agricultural land. And what that's forced is the farmers that normally would lease this land for their crops, silage or soybeans or corn or whatever, but all of a sudden now they've got to go way further out and truck it a longer distance. I know that as you just said, the more that it costs for them to put in a solar field, the more they make.
Ken, I want to just pause here and allow Tom to respond to this tension point with solar farms and croplands.
It is a tension point around the state. We've seen concerns raised about on this issue, and I think one of the challenges is that farmers are actually making the decision to lease their land to solar companies. Farmers and landowners are making their decisions to get a different. It's a different form of cash crop. It's a lease payment from an energy company, but I know there have been studies that showed that with the solar transition or clean energy transition, some farmland would be used for that, but much more farmland would not be used. It's a fraction of what the whole state was. It is affecting certain areas that are near that are prime for prime in terms of being near the easy access to the energy grid. Mm-hmm. So certain areas are being affected more than others, and it is a tension point.
Tom Content leads the consumer advocacy group Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin as we examine issues related to utility regulation and services in the state. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As Wisconsin works toward the goal of net zero emissions by 2050, we circle around to the consumer advocacy organization Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin to learn about potential changes to how utilities are regulated and effects on ratepayers and climate goals. Call in with a question. You can share comments at any point, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Tom Content is here, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board. Tom, returning here to the Public Service Commission, Rebecca Cameron-Vox stepping down this month as chair after 5 years, how would you rate the job she did?
I think she brought a very balanced approach to regulation. I think overall, she was able to demystify and open up the tent, if you will, of this kind of murky area of regulation of our life. The utilities we get affects all of us, and it's in a period of rapid change, and by inviting new people into the conversations at the Public Service Commission, groups that hadn't been involved before, I think it's opened up the process. It kind of is uncomfortable to have wonky utility types and average Joe customers in the room at the same time. For some of the utility folks, they weren't used to that at some of the meetings that were held at the Public Service Commission. But the more people get involved and the more people can understand what can be a confusing area, the more we can all have a voice in the decisions that are made that affect our future. And we had concerns when she came from a utility background. We weren't sure as the customer group that often goes up against We Energies in the cases, we weren't sure what that was going to mean. And I think overall it was very balanced. And she had a real focus on affordability.
Something she would tell us in conversations was that she took an all-of-the-above approach to energy, meaning that includes clean energy and fossil fuels, all of the above. How should we view that all-of-the-above approach, I wonder, from the perspective of Citizens Utility Board?
I mean, I think we follow the data in terms of what's most cost-effective. We have economists who are looking at all the different energy options that are out there, and we're in the middle of this transformation where the utilities' decarbonization goals are driving change, but also the dramatic drop in the price of solar is driving rapid investment, and then the incentives enabled from the Inflation Reduction Act are making that even more attractive. So I think the challenge is what does all of the above look like down the road as the utilities shift away from coal, and one of the big challenges is what's going to be cost effective, 10 years from now that will 10 or 15 years from now that will actually enable those goals to happen. And there are some big question marks. There's talk about nuclear power, which is very expensive. There's also talk about longer duration battery storage, which the costs are coming down all the time, but it's still more expensive than the conventional lithium ion batteries that are prevalent today.
Let's bring on Dave in Door County. Dave, hi. Go ahead.
Hello.
Hi.
Yeah, my question is would this give the commission more authority to actually help solar farms? Because I see solar farms as a big positive. Small farmers have an income. The grid would be more stable. Power is added to the grid in multiple places. There's more money coming into the grid from other sources. And even you said earlier, like when we have those high peak power outputs, when everybody's got their air conditioning on, think about it. Solar is really adding power to the grid then. So would this allow more solar farms? Because I think that is the right direction to go.
Dave, you're cutting out just a bit, so I'm going to toss this back to Tom. Tom, go ahead.
No, I think Dave raises a good point. I mean, I think we are going to see more solar projects, and if we have the right policies, we can actually empower customers with solar to be part of the solution too, and that's the third party solar issue is one solution in terms of enabling customers to lease their panels instead of just owning their panels is one solution we think needs a legislative fix at some point, hopefully sooner rather than later, but if you can empower customers to be part of the solution. We are moving from this old system that was all one big power plant and sending things out like from the hub of a spoke on a wheel out to lots of different power sources, kind of more distributed and more closer to where people are using their energy.
Let's bring in Marty now in Lake Forest. Marty, what's on your mind?
I've read some articles that have stated that they've been successful in growing crops underneath solar panels. Can you give me an update on any progress with that?
Anything
yes,
there,
I'm
Tom?
The,
yeah.
Yeah, I'm not the biggest expert on this, but agrivoltaics is actually a new thing that is being discussed and there are initial projects being deployed. I know when I was reporting for the Journal Sentinel, our photographers were and our readers were blown away by images of sunflowers interspersed among solar panels, but they're at a project south of Milwaukee. But in terms of these larger projects, I think there are ways to do it in terms of spacing of the panels, and growing the most appropriate crops. But agrivoltaics is a trend that I think we'll be seeing more of.
Tom Content, Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin, as we talk about utilities and regulation. You can join in questions and comments, 800-642-1234. Tom, the Federal Inflation Reduction Act allocated $149 million to Wisconsin that can be used for rebates for home energy conservation. And the Wisconsin Focus on Energy program is holding public meetings seeking input on how to structure these rebate programs. How would you like to see these programs structured?
I mean, I think what we like in terms of what's already happened is that having Focus on Energy be the provider, since Focus on Energy is already in the business of providing rebates, Wisconsin can have an efficient kind of one-stop shop of how those rebates are awarded. I think it has to be, we're looking forward to seeing customers being able to take advantage of these rebates starting, we hope, later this year. It's significant rebates in terms of energy efficiency, solar heat pumps, you name it. And it's one thing we'd like to see looked at is, you know, as long as it's, you know, soundly administered with proper oversight, can some of these rebates be made retroactive for projects that are already underway?
Oh, and so that would bring in a larger number of people who could also get in on the rebate if they have, say, a system that is, you know, in the works, or, you know, some solar panels that they want to put on their roof now and not wait for a rebate to kick in.
Yeah, that's kind of what we're hearing from the contractor community, is this kind of this whole stop and start aspect of this thing. And what one thing that I would suggest to people who are thinking about making a change around the house to shore up their energy is make a plan now and check out the tax credits now, because the tax credits have been in effect since the law was passed in 2022. And so there are ways, there are tax credits that you can take advantage of, and even for making that plan through getting an energy audit for your house. And that can help you map out the steps that you can take for so you'll be ready when those rebates are available, because we want to take advantage of all this federal money that's coming into Wisconsin. It saving energy through these rebates saves you as a customer, but it'll actually save us all, because we won't have to build as many power plants.
Turning our attention again to the state legislature, where committees that oversee utilities this week, they held a joint public hearing focused on the evolution of energy in Wisconsin. And, you know, what do you want these committees to prioritize?
I mean, I think they're looking ahead at innovative technologies, which is important, and the whole industry is. But I think we also need to be in the here and now and think about how we're planning our system, what kind of cost controls can we have in place, whether that's allowing competitive bidding to continue into the for big power line projects, because there's a bill in the legislature right now that would prevent that, and is one of the most lobbied bills. It is the most lobbied bill, much more than the Mary Miller Park bill or the American Family bill or the alcohol bill. There's a lot of money being spent on something that's actually going to just drive up our prices. And so when, if there are 50 utility lobbyists running around the Capitol trying to get something, Cubs mantra is hold on to your wallets. And that we're worried that that bill is getting close to being considered in the Senate and the Assembly as the legislative session wraps up.
Tom, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Tom Content is Executive Director of the Citizens Utility Board of Wisconsin. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We hear from an anti-Trump group, the Republican Accountability Project, about how the GOP presidential primary season is unfolding. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. This week, music fans are looking back on the 65th anniversary of the day the music died. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a tribute to one of the musicians who passed on that tragic day and his time in Wisconsin.
Buddy Holly is a rock and roll legend. In the 1950s, he became a musical torchbearer, helping popularize the genre with his band, The Crickets. They had big hits with songs like That'll Be the Day and Peggy Sue.
If you knew Peggy Sue, then you know why I feel blue without Peggy. My Peggy Sue.
Holly was a massive influence on musicians like Bob Dylan and Bruce Springsteen and helped shape the sounds of bands like the Rolling Stones and the Beatles, who covered his songs.
Words of love you, whisper soft and true. Darling, I love you.
Holly's life was cut short following a plane crash on the day the music died. Just 2 days before that, his second-to-last show was in Green Bay, Wisconsin, at the Riverside Ballroom. Author and Buddy Holly fan, Dean Robbins, reflects back on that fateful tour, which included a number of stops in Wisconsin.
Buddy Holly's death is usually associated with Clear Lake, Iowa. That's where he played his final rock and roll show on February 2, 1959. Buddy was headlining a tour called the Winter Dance Party. It began in Milwaukee's Million Dollar Ballroom and included stops in Appleton, Green Bay, and Kenosha, along with small towns in Iowa and Minnesota. A callous booking agent scheduled the dates haphazardly. The musicians had to travel hundreds of miles on unreliable buses. Then a blizzard. One night, their bus died on the way to Appleton, stranding them on a deserted highway in minus 30 temperatures. They had to set fire to newspapers to stay warm. A couple days later, on the road from Green Bay to Clear Lake, Buddy had his brainstorm. He would charter a plane for a hassle-free trip to the next gig, for himself and tour mates Richie Valens and the Big Bopper. They all went down together in a snowstorm, a tragedy known as the day the music died.
Memories will follow me forever.
Whenever it turns to winter in Wisconsin, I fantasize about seeing one of Buddy's last shows here in 1959. He played Peggy Sue, That'll Be the Day, and other irrepressible songs that set the style for early rock and roll.
All those precious things we shared.
No matter how gloomy I feel when I think about Buddy's shortened career, I can't help but smile when I hear this profoundly simple music. With his elastic vocals and ecstatic guitar, Buddy embodied the hopeful, joyful, youthful rock and roll spirit that shook up the record industry in the late 1950s.
Well, that'll be the day when you say goodbye. Yes, that'll be the day when you make me cry. You say you're gonna leave, you know it's a lie, 'cause that'll be the day when I die.
I also fantasize about meeting Buddy after one of his Wisconsin shows. Back then, rock stars didn't hide behind their security guards. I imagine telling him how happy his songs make me feel,
and then offering to drive him to the next date in my car so he doesn't have to travel on unreliable buses or planes. Of course, I can only fantasize for so long before cold, hard reality returns. Buddy did charter that plane. He died at 22, never knowing that he influenced the Beatles and the Rolling Stones and changed the course of music history. My gloom starts to set in again. Luckily, there's a sure cure for gloominess in this world. It's Buddy Holly's music.
Author Dean Robbins of Madison brought us that tribute to musician Buddy Holly.
Every day, it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come my way.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook and Instagram. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Come what may, do you ever long for true love from me? Every day it's getting closer, going faster than a roller coaster. Love like yours will surely come by.
It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. A new Marquette University Law School poll finds President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump are tied in a hypothetical rematch in Wisconsin. In the lead up to Super Tuesday, when the most states vote in the presidential primary cycle, we discuss the Republican nominating race, and we hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Gunnar Raymer is here, political director for the Republican Accountability PAC. Gunnar, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks so much for having me.
So the aggregate polling site, 538, estimating 75% of Republican voters support Trump for the nomination. And you've been conducting focus groups with voters who've supported Trump. Why are many Republicans again supporting Trump this election?
Yeah, it's a good question. And I would say that after the midterms in 2022, in the early part of February 2023, there was a sense among Republican primary voters of wanting to move on, right? They were frustrated with the Republicans' midterm performance, and the clear alternative was Florida Governor Ron DeSantis, right? He won Florida by about 20 points when a lot of Republicans had a red wave turn into a red mirage, and they were disappointed with Trump, and they saw DeSantis' performance in Florida and said, oh, he is, as a focus group participant said, he is Trump without the baggage, or another one said he is Trump not on steroids, right? That he was the clear alternative. But as we saw before DeSantis announced, he signed a six-week abortion ban, which countered the best pitch that he had, which was electability. And then these indictments came out against former President Trump. And there was a series of indictments. And what that did is it sucked up the oxygen around the news cycle and created this sustained rally around Trump effect, right? These indictments that came out last year remind Republican primary voters why they liked him in the first place. And that is the tapping into the victimhood grievance politics that ultimately animates the Republican primary base. And there just was a lack of political talent from Republicans. And we have seen a consolidation among the more establishment Republicans rally behind Nikki Haley, and she did okay in New Hampshire. We saw her lose the Nevada primary to none of the above candidates. And ultimately, yes, Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee because the base wants him, the base likes him, and they didn't see any clear alternatives once they saw DeSantis as an actual retail politician.
So it sounds like it is apparent to you that Trump will likely be the GOP nominee for president once more in 2024.
Oh, absolutely. If you take a look at even South Carolina for Nikki Haley, she is down by double digits, right? It depends what poll you look at. It could be 30 points or 40 points. The problem for Nikki Haley is that in South Carolina, she's actually a known quantity, right? She's underwater among Republican primary voters nationally, too. Again, Nikki Haley represents a Republican campaign out of 2012 or 2015, right? That she is the establishment pick. And that is the exact opposite of what the base wants. And the way that we think about the Republican primary electorate, there's four buckets. There is the always Trump, which represents about 30% of the Republican Party. They are Trump or bust. That is all they want. There's another 30% that is maybe Trump, right? That they liked the job he did as president, but hey, maybe they'd be open to an alternative if that came into play. There is the move on Trump, which represents another 30% who was very much open to an alternative after the midterms early part of this year, but were trying to find a candidate that they could all rally behind. And we've seen some of that support go for Haley as the other establishment picks dropped out. And then there is 10%, which is the Never Trump, which we are part of, coalition. It is not a big part of the Republican Party, but is it a significant part of the Republican Party in so much as they reject Donald Trump and his brand of politics? And they also are the voters who decide elections, especially in the swing states, including in Wisconsin.
So as the Republican primary season, carries on, is this category of Never Trump growing or shrinking? What do you see?
I think that the Never Trump coalition is just about 10%. I think it in the past few years, it has been that number. It remains that number. But I think ultimately, these voters reject Donald Trump. And the difficult spot that Republicans have put themselves in is that it has always been one thing to win a Republican primary and have to run to the right and then move back into the middle and pivot, right, to appeal to the swing voters. But Republicans no longer have to run to the right. They run Trumpward, and it is becoming increasingly difficult to pivot back. I think that in 2022, we saw a great example of this in Wisconsin, and we were against Tim Michaels in that governor's race, right? That we saw swing voters. These are the voters who live outside of the big cities in Wisconsin. They live in the outer rings of Milwaukee, of Madison, of Green Bay. And we saw the ticket splitting happen, right? In support of Tony Evers. And I think that we are going to see swing voters once again reject Donald Trump because they don't like his brand of politics. And I will just say, there are a few caveats to that, which is when you talk to a swing voter right now, and when I say swing voter, we also call them flippers. And that can mean that they voted for Trump in 2016, and they voted for Biden in 2020, or at least they left the top of the ticket plank in 2020, or they voted third party in 2020. These are the voters who decide elections. That right now, when you talk to them, they have an unfavorable opinion or very unfavorable opinion of both Donald Trump and Joe Biden. And that dynamic was not the same back in 2020, right? Hmm. Voters, swing voters could project their hopes on Biden. He could be the unity candidate, but now Biden has a record. And it's one that is not particularly popular with swing voters. And that Biden is front of center to them. He is the president. We saw what happened, which I think was a disaster yesterday with the report that came out for Biden and his age and his forgetfulness. And so voters have forgotten in a way about what they disliked so much about Donald Trump. And they remember what they dislike about Joe Biden just because he is the president right now. So it is a particular challenge as we try to sustain and keep this anti-Trump coalition is that we are dealing with an incumbent Democratic president.
Gunnar Raimer is a political director for the Republican Accountability PAC. That's an anti-Trump group formed in the wake of the storming of the U.S. Capitol on January 6, 2021. Call in with a question. You can share your comments at 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Republican National Convention is about 5 months away in Milwaukee. We hear from the Republican Accountability PAC about how the primary season is unfolding as former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley is the last remaining significant rival to frontrunner Donald Trump. Call in with a question. You can share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Gunnar Raymer is political director for the Republican Accountability PAC. Gunnar, we heard the New York Times reporting Republican National Committee Chair Ronna McDaniel is planning to step down from the position after the South Carolina Republican primary. Why is McDaniel stepping down?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think that it speaks to the dysfunction that the Republican Party is facing right now. We saw the disaster over the failed impeachment over the Department of Homeland Security, Alejandro Mayorkas. We saw the dysfunction over the deal in the Senate. And I guess I think the larger point is, and then we see that the chair of the RNC is going to be dropping out. But I think that why this is such a missed opportunity for the Democratic Party with this report about Joe Biden coming out is that Republicans looked really bad. And we saw back in 2022 when a bunch of extreme candidates were winning the Republican primary, swing voters took a look at that and said, oh, I don't want to support this kind of Republican Party. And I think that swing voters could have taken a look at all of this dysfunction among the Republican Party and said, oh, geez, this is just another reminder of why I can't get behind this type of Republican Party, right? You have these traditional Reagan-type Republicans who very much want the party to turn back into time, even though it's not going to, because Donald Trump has taken over the Republican Party and seen all this dysfunction. And yet, with the report coming out with Joe Biden yesterday, it really takes away from all of that, right? It changed the contours of the news cycle. And I think it was such a missed opportunity by having this come out for the Democratic Party, because there is all this dysfunction coming out with the Republican Party. There is so much division among both rank and file Republicans, Republican voters, at least in some ways. And that was just another example of the internal dynamics playing out.
So the Times also reporting that the leading candidate to replace McDaniel falsely believes there was a mass voter fraud in the 2020 election. How common is that fallacy in the base today?
Oh, it absolutely remains, right? It seems that if you are not to believe that the 2020 election wasn't stolen from Donald Trump, that you have no place there. I think a great example of that is look at what happened to the 10 House Republicans who voted in support of impeaching Donald Trump. 8 of them are no longer elected officials. Mitt Romney's retiring. And if you look at the 2 elected officials who voted to impeach Donald Trump, one of them, Dan Newhouse of Washington State, got lucky that there is a top 2 system there and skated by because the MAGA vote was split up in that district. And the second member, David Valadao, someone who is close allies with then Speaker Kevin McCarthy, faced no strong primary challenger that was Trump endorsed. So to not believe the election wasn't stolen, you have no place in the Republican Party. At least that's what elected officials, Republican leadership wants you to believe. The under-discussed, I think it is under-discussed point, is that how much Donald Trump has fundamentally changed the Republican Party. Back in 2015, 2016, he started it, and it has sustained, right? I guess I was naive that after January 6th, I thought that the Republican leadership would say January 6th was terrible. I guess some of them did at the time, but they quickly scurried back in support of Trump, right? Kevin McCarthy went down to Mar-a-Lago just a few weeks later. I thought that after the midterms and all of Trump's candidates lost and a lot of winnable races, while it was a poor environment for Democrats nationally, I thought the Republican Party was going to move on. But as we sit here today, it is very clear that the base wants Donald Trump and all of the forces that he has unleashed on the Republican Party. But I will just say that that brand of politics has been rejected by swing voters time and time again. We saw it happen with the Republican Party during the midterms in 2018. We saw it with Donald Trump's candidacy himself in 2020. And we saw it play out last cycle in 2022 when typically the incumbent president's party does very poorly during that first midterm. So I hope that these swing voters continue to send a signal, a message, a very clear message to Republican elites and Republican primary voters that this type of politics isn't going to play out. But yet again, I am unsurprised that an election denier is going to be elevated to a position of power.
We're talking about national politics with Gunnar Raymer with us, with the Republican Accountability PAC. You can join in questions and comments at 800-642-1234. Gunnar, I just want to take a moment here to look at Congress. There's this resolution circulating in the House that states that Trump, quote, did not engage in insurrection. What do you make of these actions?
Well, I think it's despicable. I think that anybody who looks at January 6th and downplay it is incredibly wrong. They're on the wrong side of history. I can't think of anything less constitutional. That's something that conservatives and Republicans have always said that they're in support of, than trying to overturn a free and fair election. And that's exactly what the election denialism that Donald Trump has instilled in the Republican Party. That's exactly what January 6th is about. We saw it, I think this came out last night, that Elise Stefanik, who is vying to be Trump's vice president, is downplaying yet again January 6th. I think that it is terrible. But also, putting January 6th back in the news cycle is good for the Democratic Party, right? When you talk to swing voters, they are bothered, they're repulsed by the idea of January 6th. And I said it earlier, right, that Joe Biden is top of mind for swing voters, but I think as they begin to internalize this idea that Donald Trump is going to be the Republican nominee, Joe Biden is going to be the Democratic nominee, and they are once again reminded of all the reasons why they disliked Donald Trump, and one of the main reasons is January 6th, that we are going to see a shift in the polling. We're going to see a shift among focus group participants who are these flippers that voted for Trump in 16, oftentimes voted for Biden in 20, and ultimately, that can be a good thing for the Democratic Party. And one last note on this, that it is terrible. We have a two-party system in this country, and that's just going to be the way it is. And to have one of the major political parties not believe in free and fair elections is incredibly dangerous. And we saw what happened play out on January 6th. And looking ahead to the general election, we will see what happens. I think the contests in the swing states, including Wisconsin, it's going to be incredibly tight. And I am worried over a continued and emphasized use of this election denialism and what that means for our country.
Gunnar, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Gunnar Raymer is political director for the Republican Accountability PAC. I'm Kate Archer Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Puberty may be a difficult time for kids, and the early arrival of this developmental milestone to adulthood may bring additional physical and emotional stresses. As scientists attempt to pinpoint why puberty is occurring increasingly earlier in kids now compared to decades ago, we explore early puberty care. You can call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. David Allen is a pediatrics professor in the Division of Endocrinology and Diabetes at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Allen, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks, Happy to be here. Thank you.
Yes. And Jane Mendel here as well, clinical psychologist and an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Cornell University, where she is director of the Adolescent Transitions Lab. Jane, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here as well.
Jane, let's start with you. The National Institutes of Health saying the average age of puberty or when a child becomes sexually mature is between 8 and 13 for girls, ages 9 and 14 for boys. How is the onset of puberty changing for children?
So it is definitely starting earlier these days than it has been historically. I mean, one thing to know is the timing of puberty has bounced around through human history there, and it really hit an all-time lateness in the 19th and the beginning of the 20th century. But there are records from Hippocrates, from ancient Egypt, showing that it used to be more like 12 or 13. Now, one of the things that's tricky is it can sometimes be a little difficult to measure puberty, but everything speaks to it starting a little earlier and ending at about the same time as it used to. And so it seems to be also a little longer than it has been previously. So it's earlier and longer. So kids are just spending more of their lives during this transition than, as far as we can tell, they have previously.
It makes me wonder why this transition has bounced around through generations, through centuries even.
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question, which people are devoting huge amounts of research time and brain power to trying to figure out. And I think there is no simple reason. David may want to jump in and contribute on this as well. But a lot of the hypotheses center on endocrine-disrupting chemicals, life stress, changes in diet and nutrition.
We're going to unpack those things as well. But Dr. Allen, you know, what is your sense here? Why is puberty starting earlier for children?
Well, as Jane pointed out, if we look back from the 1960s, which is kind of these decades where this has been closely tracked, you know, the most maybe apparent change that's happened in the childhood population, it has to do with the adiposity, you know, the degree of obesity and nutritional status. And we know that nutrition is one thing that sort of propels the growth and development of a child forward. So that's one tight association that I think most people agree is playing some role. But the other aspects that were mentioned are also important in terms of life stressors, potential exposure to what are called endocrine disrupting chemicals, some other aspects of our population that have changed with regard to demographics. One thing I did want to emphasize that I think was, you know, that Jane mentioned was that, you know, it's the process. Puberty is a process, and it takes years to unfold. So when we talk about children reaching sexual maturity, that is the end of the process. And I think one of the very important points that was made was that while the beginning of puberty has moved earlier, the end of puberty has moved earlier much less. And so this process, as was pointed out, has been kind of extended for the most part in most of the children that start earlier.
We're talking about puberty with Dr. David Allen there at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Jane Mendel is here from Cornell University's Adolescent Transitions Lab. And you can join in. Questions and comments, 800-642-1234. So, Dr. Allen, what are signs of puberty that are changing for children?
Well, puberty actually is a complex process by which, you know, a certain part of the brain starts to send messages to ovaries or testicles to make hormones that then cause the physical changes, emotional changes, and capacity for reproduction. So, you know, the signs that we're talking about as the initiation of puberty are changes in the size of the testicles in boys, which is a fairly subtle finding, and in girls, you know, early breast development. And then there's a series of stages that occur between that and, for instance, for girls, the onset of menstrual periods. One of the most fascinating things about the puberty system is that this whole mechanism is well in place when babies are in the womb. And what's actually happening in childhood is not that people are being spurred into puberty, but rather that the inhibition of puberty that happens after we're all born is released. And so, as was pointed out earlier, one of the great mysteries that still exists in medicine is, you know, exactly what is that signal We know a lot of things that play a role, but what actually is the key signal that turns on the timing of puberty is still a bit of a mystery.
Well, let's step back here and look a bit at the mental health picture. Jane Mendel, if a child starts experiencing puberty at, say, age 7, should caregivers be concerned?
I think it would warrant a call to the child's pediatrician and a conversation with that pediatrician. One thing, whenever I'm talking about this, I'm always cognizant of who's listening to me and what might they be thinking about for their child. So one thing I just want to take a little bit of a detour to say is that everything we're talking about is in large generalities across the entire population. That's what we know as a trend, but it certainly isn't meant to describe each individual's experience. But we do know that the earlier kids reach puberty, the harder it tends to be psychologically. I'm sure many of you are thinking that 7, 8, 9, 10, these are children, but they're going through a transition physically that is essentially the start of adolescence. And so from a psychological perspective, it can be very, very hard to become sexually mature, to look visibly older to other people, to have all of the things that go along with looking older happening to you before you're necessarily prepared for it to happen. But in answer to the short question, if we see signs of puberty at age 7, that is unusually early. It's closer to what we think of as precocious puberty versus earlier on the typical side of development. And I would certainly think about calling a pediatrician in that circumstance.
And just for terminology here, precocious puberty, is the frequency of early puberty the same as precocious puberty?
You know, we think of precocious puberty as more of a medical condition, and there are treatments available to deal with it and manage it. And then we think of early puberty as kids who are going through puberty at the expected time, but they're on the early side of it compared to other kids their age.
Okay. You know, Dr. Allen, in terms of early puberty affecting other bodily functions, does early puberty affect someone, the child's height?
Yes. I mean, you know, yeah, we all know that the period of puberty is a time when growth rate increases. You know, we are somewhat programmed as individuals. Much of this is genetic, but as we pointed out earlier, there's some other influences that determine when this process begins. But once the puberty hormones are being made, you know, then the growth rate accelerates, but at the same time, the growth plates are maturing. So the earlier one enters into puberty, then usually the earlier one finishes growth. And most of us can reflect back on our years in junior high school and high school and recognize the differences that occur there.
The growth spurts. Mm-hmm.
Exactly. Right.
Yeah. UW School of Medicine and Public Health pediatric endocrinologist David Allen with us, and associate professor in the Department of Psychology, clinical psychologist Jane Mendel from Cornell, examining the complexities of early puberty and fielding your questions. You can share comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Scientists find puberty is starting earlier in girls and boys compared to generations ago. We examine the complexities of early puberty and hear from you. Call in with a question. You can share your perspective, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. David Allen is a pediatric endocrinologist at the UW School of Medicine and Public Health and past president of the Pediatric Endocrine Society. Jane Mendel is here, licensed clinical psychologist, leads the Adolescent Transitions Lab at Cornell University. Dr. Allen, unpack diet, if you could, just a bit more. How much of this downward trend in the age children are starting puberty, is that related to what we're feeding our kids?
Well, it's a very interesting question because it has two dimensions. One is, you know, how much are we feeding our kids? And the second part of it is like what we're feeding our kids. you know, I think there's been a clear correlation between the changes in obesity rates in children over the past 50 years and this change in puberty. And there's some good physiologic reasons why that might happen. We know that hormones like insulin, which tend to be increased when children have greater weight, that can stimulate pubertal development. We know another hormone made by the fat cells themselves, leptin, is an important facilitator of puberty onset. And we know that children that have overnutrition also just in general grow a little bit faster, show some advancement in their development. And so, you know, that part of things is probably evolutionarily, you know, one of the main reasons why we're seeing this trend toward earlier puberty. The second part of your question about, you know, is qualitatively, are there things that we're really feeding the children that affect this or can have some of these hormonal effects? That's a very intense area of investigation right now. What are what we call these sort of endocrine disrupting compounds? You know, there is some pretty good information that extremely large amounts of soy, for instance, or soy dependent diets can have some estrogenic effects. There are some other not foods, but other treatments that some families have used, where like lavender oil was another compound that has been associated with breast development. So it's possible that there are some qualitative aspects of exposure, but those have been very difficult to get a handle on, and no one has really yet been able to draw a tight correlation there yet.
And just a follow up, it seems as if the National Institutes of Health is really looking at substances like found in personal hygiene products and cosmetics and skincare products that might have links to early onset of puberty. What are you watching for there?
Well, what we're watching for is just trying to take a history. Like I said, we don't have enough information to advise families to avoid particular aspects of these compounds that are, for instance, in cosmetics. So I think we need to be careful about doing that, because there certainly is some suspicion that needs to be investigated. But at this point, we don't have enough information to really prohibit exposure. There are a few things that have kind of like been notorious that I've personally had experience with, in particular, lavender oil or some other oils that seem to be able to have some ability to bind the estrogen receptor and cause some changes of puberty. So those are maybe more well-defined, but in general, I don't think we have enough information to make specific dietary recommendations.
Let's bring in Barbara in Cross Plains. Barbara, what is your question?
Hello. Thank you for having this subject discussed. I'm a grandmother of 6 daughters, and my own daughter was noticing her 7-year-old having early onset of puberty signs. And the two of us realized at the same time that was going on, I was premenopausal and I was using a soy supplement to relieve my symptoms. And she was feeding her daughters soy milk and soy products to avoid meat and dairy. So we both wondered, could a soy intake affect puberty? And secondly, please address that 7-year-old who experiences early onset. She also experienced the mental health issues of mood swings and depression. And so I think that's an important thing to discuss as well.
Barbara, thank you for bringing those two items to the conversation. And Jane Mendel, I'm going to start with you first, especially on the mental health aspect.
Yeah, and thanks for talking about this, Barbara. This is actually the core of what I spend a lot of time studying. One of the things that we know, and this is especially true for girls, although it is true for all kids, it is really, really accentuated for girls, is that kids who go through puberty at young ages are more prone to psychological challenges, particularly depression, but also anxiety, and also body dissatisfaction, which is a risk for developing eating disorders down the road. Nobody exactly knows why, and there's probably not a simple answer, but there are a few things that we know contribute, and then there are a couple of things that we have discovered in my research lab can help, which I would like to share with you as well. So a lot of why we think it's hard is because kids are encountering challenges, situations, life experiences, and assumptions from others that are based on how they look, but they're still very much not at the cognitive or emotional level of development that they are showing physically. So they are assumed to be older than they are. It can be sometimes challenging. And I would love to hear from Barbara if you're willing to share your granddaughter's experience, but it can sometimes be challenging to maintain friendships with kids who haven't developed at a similar rate and whose lives suddenly seem very different from your own. And they can also just be treated differently by other people as well. And it provokes a real reevaluation of who they are and where they are. And it's incredibly confusing. We know that kids who think a lot about the fact that they're going through puberty, why it's worrisome for them, what it means in terms of other aspects of their life, we know those kids tend to have a harder time with it. That's called rumination. We see it linked not just with puberty, but with mood changes at other ages. And in my research lab, we have done some work where we had kids, lots and lots of kids, tell us about their lives at puberty. And then we analyzed what they said about it using a form of text analysis. And we discovered that kids who were able to put some form of coherent narrative to what was happening to them, which is called meaning making, that that was actually protective against finding puberty more challenging. Now, the thing that's tricky, I know, right? It was really interesting. And also, one of the things that's really bleak about studying puberty is that you can't really do much to change it, and you can't really do much to change the reactions of other people whom you may never see, who might be treating a child differently in some way. But to be able to latch on to a concrete thing such as meaning making that a child can change within themselves is really powerful and was really inspiring for us. So the thing is that the kids who were able to do it naturally in our research, it's easy to wonder if those kids may have had a psychological leg up. But we know from other bodies of psychological research that parents and teachers can build meaning making in kids. And there are ways to do that. And one of the ways to do it is creating a story out of what's happening and connecting the person you used to be with the person you are today. So that is some clear advice that we can give to families and to kids to try to think about who they were, where they are today. What are the threads of continuity across that?
Jane Mendel. I'm sorry. I'm going to just reintroduce you here. Jane Mendel at Cornell University's Adolescent Transitions Lab. Dr. David Allen with us at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Dr. Allen, I just want you to be able to chime in here as well. What comes up when you hear from Barbara's story?
Yeah, thanks, Barbara, for the question. One important point I want to make is that many times signs of puberty are not puberty. So there's a distinction between children that present with either, for instance, isolated breast development or sometimes isolated pubic hair, which is a fairly common occurrence and doesn't often signify that puberty is actually beginning. So it's really important to distinguish the two, because the outcome, you know, down the road is different. How you would approach it, as Jane pointed out, psychologically is different. And many times reassurance that this is a self-limited and non-progressing situation is really important and extremely helpful for a family. So it actually sounds, Barb, from your question that that might have been happening. In other words, you know, exposure to a large amount of soy might have resulted in some breast development. That doesn't necessarily mean that the process of puberty is beginning, and, you know, perhaps with the change in the exposure, then things would return to a more normal sequence.
Dr. David Allen there, Chief of the Pediatric Diabetes and Endocrinology Division at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Clinical psychologist Jane Mendel is an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Cornell, leads its Adolescent Transitions Lab. Call in, be part of this conversation with a question, share your thoughts, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kay Darcher-Kent. Scientists over the years amass a body of research tracking how puberty is starting at younger ages, and we examine health risks and what to know when kids are transitioning from childhood to adulthood before the average age. As we discuss early puberty care, call in with a question. You can add comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Dr. David Allen is a professor of pediatrics in the Division of Endocrinology and Diabetes at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Jane Mendel is a clinical psychologist and an associate professor in the Department of Psychology at Cornell University. Jane, as you talk about narrative meaning-making and threads that help connect childhood and adulthood and finding meaning in girls' experiences, are children who experience puberty early at risk of mental health challenges later in life?
Unfortunately, they are. And we know that, you know, the studies haven't gone super, super far into the future, but they do go into the early 30s. And we see that kids, girls particular, I should specify that all this research has been conducted on girls, but that girls who get their periods at younger ages, and getting your period is, and the age at which you get your period is one of the really clear indicators of physical development and pubertal development. So girls who get their periods at younger ages are more likely to show elevated rates of depression in their early 30s. And this seems to be primarily because they get depressed as adolescents in the aftermath of going through puberty, and they struggle to recover from it. Again, I want to emphasize these are population trends. I worry that it sounds gloom and doomy, although I do think an entire generation of kids going through puberty at progressively younger ages is something we should worry about. But yeah, we do see that the effects are long-lasting. They're long-lasting primarily because once people become depressed as adolescents, it can be hard to shift their lives. And they experience a number of things during adolescence that are enduring or long-term vulnerabilities for mental health, including higher rates of sexual trauma is probably one of the biggest, as well as discontinuing education and high school dropout is another thing that helps explain why girls who go through puberty at younger ages are more likely to show depression in the early 30s.
With the way parents or guardians interact with a child experiencing puberty early, what impact does that have?
You know, there's not been, the main focus in puberty has always been on the peers and a little bit less so on the parents.
Okay.
We do know that parents can scaffold the experience of puberty for their kids in ways that can be helpful. One bit of advice that I often give to folks, which I will share with you here, is that puberty is a biological transition, but it really involves transformation across virtually all domains of life. So yes, there are these profound physical changes, but there are also social changes. There are also emotional changes. And helping kids recognize that puberty involves transformation across a lot of different domains of life can sometimes be helpful for putting it in context, because it's hard to connect those dots for yourself sometimes.
Mm.
So I think parents can provide a bit of that. And then the last thing I would say is that one of the hardest things, and again, this is for girls in particular, but menstruation is very, very challenging for girls. They're not always sure what to think of it. They're not something that they compare a lot. It is something that tends to be really private and still stigmatized or mocked a little bit within society. And we know that kids who are going through puberty who tend to think a lot about getting their period or tends to kids who tend to be more vulnerable to depression in the future. And so normalizing that transition, providing a little bit of preparation for it, I think is something that is a very, very useful thing to do.
Thank you for that. Let's bring in Nancy now in Milwaukee. Nancy, go ahead.
Hello. I have often heard that girls who menstruate late and have an early menopause, therefore having fewer monthly flux of hormones, are not as likely to ever develop breast cancer. So I'm wondering if you know of charts that support these theories, and is that perhaps not a good reason to try to delay early menstruation for girls?
Nancy, thanks for the question. Dr. Allen, can you field that?
Yeah, thank you, Nancy, for that. That's a very good question. And you know, one of the concerns that families have when girls have early onset of menses, and particularly if they go online and read about it, is some of the health concerns that have been associated with that. And as you point out, there are actually some apparently protective effects of being of late with the onset of menses. Now, having an early period before the age of 10 actually has been associated with early menopause, you know, and greater risk of breast cancer, and having periods very late actually has been apparently has some protective effect on breast cancer risk and uterine cancer risk. Importantly, I just want to point out these studies, these association studies, as Jane has already pointed out, are population studies. So for an individual patient, if you calculate the increased risk, it can be somewhat reassuring to look at that. Secondly, it's been interesting to learn that retrospective a recollection of the date of onset of menses is not as reliable as I think many of us assume. And this has been shown in some of the European studies that have actually followed populations of women from the time they were 10 years of age till they're 55 and been able to track, you know, these occurrences. And those prospective studies have actually had a more difficult time showing some of these associations than the retrospective studies. So I think there's still quite a bit to learn about that. But in answer to your question, yes, if you compare early developing girls to late developing girls, then there does seem to be some protective effects to being late. But there are also some consequences. And that's why, you know, it's a complicated question about whether to intervene and try to stop puberty, for instance, because there can be adverse effects on important features like bone strength. Okay, so a very late onset of puberty in an individual is associated with diminished bone mineral density later in life, and that can have its own complications. So it's a very good question, but it's a very complicated one too.
Dr. David Allen with us at UW School of Medicine and Public Health, Jane Mendel at Cornell's Adolescent Transitions Lab. Call in with questions and comments, 800-642-1234. And Dr. Allen, these studies are coming coming fast. There was the BMJ, Journal of Nutrition Prevention and Health, suggesting people who get their period at a young age are at a higher risk for diabetes and stroke. Is early puberty an indicator of you know, these types of physical challenges later?
Well, I like the way you put that question, because as an indicator or as a risk factor, yes, I mean, I think it's possible. And certainly with the connections that we've talked about related to obesity or other hormonal effects that are maybe playing a role in the onset of puberty, we know that those particular hormones are also associated with cardiometabolic risks later in life. Another thing that's been observed, in addition to nutrition effects, there's some birth aspects of an individual that also might influence risk. We know, for instance, that babies that are born on the small side have a higher chance of having earlier pubertal onset and also having some of these increased risk for cardiometabolic health later in life. So I think the message there would be, as an indicator, you know, that's another added incentive, you know, in those kinds of situations for emphasis on healthy lifestyle, avoidance of obesity, you know, doing all the things that we can control to try to minimize those events later in life.
Jane Mendel, when you talk about you know, some of the stigma around getting your period, I'm wondering, is that stigma playing out differently for you know, girls of color, for Black girls who go through precocious puberty, and whether that they are treated differently or stigmatized?
So the experience of puberty across race, ethnicity, and culture is so vastly different, and it's so important. We know that for Black girls in particular, one of the things that happens is something that is called adultification, where they are sexualized and treated like adults beginning at puberty in ways that doesn't necessarily seem to hold true for girls of other backgrounds. And that is, of course, reflective of some of the assumptions and the biases that are rooted in our society. I can't speak to offhand if there is more or less menstrual stigma within those communities, because I can't think of an article that has directly addressed that question. So, you know, you're reminding us of how important it is to keep doing studies and thinking about research. But I do know that there are also different ways that people will think of what it means to be psychologically healthy, what it means to thrive. And these also differ by race and ethnicity, and socioeconomic levels and cultural backgrounds and even religions. So there's not really ever a simple story, particularly when we're dealing like a society like the United States, where there's so many different backgrounds, for sure.
Yes. Jane Mendel is a clinical psychologist, directs the Adolescent Transitions Lab at Cornell. Pediatric endocrinologist David Allen is here, professor at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Call in with a question. Share your views, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Research is underway on the potential long-term health risks when puberty happens before the average age in girls and boys. And we learn about the timing of puberty and the effects on kids who start the transition to adulthood earlier than their peers. We have Dr. David Allen with us, pediatric endocrinologist at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Jane Mendel is a clinical psychologist and leads the Adolescent Transitions Lab at Cornell University. You can email ideas at WPR.org with your questions. Let's go to Rich in Rhinelander. Rich, hi.
Hi, thanks. I'm looking back to a Smithsonian Magazine article published about 2 years back about the presence of microplastics in our bloodstreams, and I believe the studies were done on adults, but I'm thinking if microplastics are circulating in my bloodstream, then they probably are just as likely to be circulating in the bloodstreams of little human beings, younger human beings, is what I mean. The other point I wanted to bring up was it seems to me across generations, our population has become more and more sedentary. I mean, people are discussing purchasing Game Boys for boys when actually boys should be out playing games. And I'll leave it at that. But there
Rich,
seem to be a lot of maybes in this.
Yeah. Rich, thank you so much for the call. Dr. Allen, go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Rich, for the question, because it brings to mind the challenge of trying to figure out whether some of these environmental exposures to, as you say, microplastics or other substances could possibly be affecting these systems. And it's complex because, you know, if some of these compounds are able to bind to receptors that are, you know, involved in the puberty process, I mean, sometimes we can see stimulatory effects, sometimes we can see inhibitory effects. Both of those have been kind of observed in some particular situations. So it is a concern. And all I can say is that, you know, people are actively looking into this. I mean, one of the biggest challenges is to try to develop systems whereby you can reliably, you know, track exposure and its effects. And I think that's really kind of where the emphasis is right now. There's been a number of anecdotal reports, but right now I think the emphasis is really on trying to do the kind of quality research that would answer the question. And your comment then about the sedentary lifestyle, of course, well, that's certainly one of the major factors that's contributing to this imbalance between, you know, nutrition in and energy expended and, accumulation of fat mass, which then generates some of these hormones, which stimulates earlier pubertal development. So that's one of the things. If families really want to know what they can do to try to avoid any unnecessary earlier onset of puberty, active lifestyle, lots of physical activity, optimal body mass index, those are steps that we know can have some effect.
Let's bring in Liz now in Lyons. Liz, hi.
Hello.
What would you like to bring up?
I was just wondering if there's a link between, and it's really for both presenters, if there's a link between the oppositional defiance disorder in girls younger than 10 and the possibility that they might be going through puberty early. Is there some type of link between the two of those?
I'm going to field that to Jane on oppositional defiant disorder.
Sure, Liz, and thanks for asking the question. So oppositional defiant disorder, and just for viewers, this is a psychological disorder that, as its name might suggest, is marked by really recurrent say no oppositional behavior and also temper or irritable mood. I am not familiar offhand with anything that directly links oppositional defiant disorder with earlier pubertal development. We do see that girls who go through early puberty are more likely to show sorts of acting out, rule-breaking, delinquent behaviors later in adolescence. But I think one thing that we should talk about that happens is that kids are, you know, they're not coming into puberty fresh from, you know, developmentally shrink wrap packages. They're coming into it with all of these life experiences. Some of them may have had already been experiencing psychological difficulties, early states of depression, early indicators of other disorders. And one of the things we know is that puberty pretty much worsens everything psychologically because it's the kind of transition that can tap people out. So one of the things we can see is that maybe if a child were experiencing irritability, temper, oppositionality as a child, and then they transition into puberty, puberty is going to more than likely worsen all of that because of the nature of the transition.
Liz, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Heather in Rhinelander. Heather, go ahead.
Hi, I have a quick question for the endocrinologist. I had a daughter that was a twin, and one of them only ended up getting growth hormone shots through the Children's in Minnesota. And did get her menstrual cycle later in life. And now I'm concerned because she's very sporadic and concerned about everything else delayed. And as I'm listening to you talk about menopause, cancer, I have a feeling that it may be difficult because it was difficult for me to get pregnant. So I'm wondering if she will maybe go through some of those things, and a lot of those things will be delayed. Do you have any knowledge or studies on that?
Thanks
for the question. Yeah, the information you're providing is somewhat limited in terms of like what might be going on with all the hormone systems of the body and not just the growth system. One thing to remember is that, you know, the delayed onset of puberty, the delayed onset of the first menstrual period, is not associated with increased risk of breast cancer or uterine cancer, or necessarily early menopause. So I think that that's more a concern of the early bloomers. So I think that, and of course, I don't know how old your granddaughter is right now, so it's hard to know. Remember that when puberty begins, even when the first menstrual period begins, there's a 12 to 18 month period, you know, before we really expect that there'll be regular cycles. And so we have to provide a lot of reassurance in those early years that this can be a variation of normal and, you know, not to overinterpret some irregularity at that time. So I don't have a better answer than, you know, with the information that you've provided. And maybe the endocrinologists that are still following her would be able to answer your question.
Heather, thank you for that. You know, a group we haven't discussed here, Jane Mendel, is if a teacher that knows that a student is experiencing puberty before their peers, should the teacher do anything differently to address that child's needs?
So what I would say is that's schools and social experiences can be hard for early developers. And we know that early developers are just statistically speaking across the board more likely to be targets of rumors and victimization and bullying by their peers than other kids. So I would hope that teachers keep an eye on those dynamics that can be happening and work not so much with an individual child, but with the classroom surrounding them that might make puberty more challenging for them.
Hmm. Dr. Allen, can precocious puberty, can it be slowed down naturally at all?
Excellent question, because that's frequently what families want to know. Obviously, everybody's probably heard in the press, there's some very effective, you know, treatments that can essentially halt puberty, but these are extraordinarily expensive and very involved. And I think, you know, sometimes can take a situation that's a variation of normal and send a child the message that there's something really wrong with their body, which we'd like to avoid. So I think the things that we have talked about in terms of like increasing physical activity, minimizing obesity, I mean, those are going to be probably in a family's armamentarium, the most effective ways of, say, slowing the onset of puberty. Whether or not those things, once puberty has begun, whether they can slow the progression, I don't think we really have information. We don't have good data to suggest that. But those would be the steps that we would, you know, advise. And in terms of all the other points that we've made about future potential health risks of precocious puberty or early onset puberty, you know, those can also have benefits for the long run. So,
well,
difficult to achieve, but that's probably the best advice that we would have for families.
Thank you both for joining us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thank you very much for the opportunity.
Dr. David Allen there, pediatrics professor in the Division of Endocrinology and Diabetes at UW School of Medicine and Public Health. Jane Mendel, clinical psychologist and leader of Cornell University's Adolescent Transitions Lab. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.